radio station that has been on the air in the center of the FM dial in New York City for 62 years. Or call the pledge line at 212-209-2950. It's 9 a.m. and coming up next will be Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
This is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate and agitate and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible if we are determined to and work to make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Later on, join Noelle Hanrahan, founder and director of Prison Radio, and legal counsel for Momia Abu-Jamal for our virtual radio celebration of Momia Abu-Jamal's 68th birthday after 40 years of unjust incarceration. And you're invited to send Momia a life-affirming message, as he always does to all humanity and for all. But first, we're joined by Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, foreign correspondent for 15 years for the New York Times, where he served as the Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief. His books include American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, Death of the Liberal Class and the War is a Force that Gives Us Meaning, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And I name the books because I think it helps define and give you an understanding of whom we are going to be speaking with. Chris Hedges, thank you for joining us.
Sure, Mimi. And we have to name the newest book because many of my students in East Jersey State Prison are devoted listeners to BAR, and this book is about them.
Please do.
Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison.
And I want you to say that one more time so we absolutely remember it.
Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison. And it's about students I taught in the college degree program through Rutgers who wrote a play about their lives called Caged that was eventually published and performed at a professional theater. And it uses that process of exploration of writing that work to explore what mass incarceration and police violence has done to them and their families.
Chris, comes a time where sometimes you want to say, stop the world, I really want to get off. And I do at this point, in order to reset the clock, set it back, to put in place the pieces, if you will, that have led us to what you describe at one point as this kind of waltz to Armageddon. What am I speaking about? Well, the war in Ukraine. And I want to take the puzzle pieces and disassemble them. Take us back to a different narrative. I don't care if it starts at 2014 or with a breakup of the Soviet Union, but help us get a better understanding of the state of empire, if you will. how we are at the place we are, where we are, among hegemonistic superpowers waltzing to Armageddon in Ukraine, which clearly has much broader implications. Indeed, I think we are in the early stages of a world war. So if you could parse out the players and help us understand and demystify and debunk a great deal of the U.S. media saber-rattling, the Russia-phobic kind of responses, and indeed those who would be apologists for invasion and so on. So it's a big task, but given your experience, your scholarship, and your sense of humanity, I know you can do that for us.
So I was in Eastern Europe in 1989, reporting on the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the assumption that all of us carried was that with the breakup of the Soviet Empire, NATO had become obsolete. NATO was created to prevent the Soviet expansion into Central and Eastern Europe. We also spoke at the time about a peace dividend, that the staggering sums of money that were poured into the military and weapons systems during the Cold War could now be invested in people, in all of the social programs that had been starved for funds because of the conflict, this global standoff between Moscow and Washington in particular. Gorbachev, who was the president of the Soviet Union at the time, reached out to Washington to build a security pact that would include Europe, the United States, and Russia. They talked about giving Russia observer status at NATO. And eventually integrating NATO. I don't know if they were serious about that, but that was a discussion at the time. And there was a promise made by the West German foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, Secretary of State James Baker, in the Reagan administration, Margaret Thatcher, the French, everyone else, that NATO would not be expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany because that was an unnecessary provocation. Russia was twice invaded, World War One and World War Two, by Germany. The century before, the French under Napoleon, they have that historical trauma of being encircled and invaded. That was understood and accepted across the political spectrum, whether that was Henry Kissinger or George Kennan or anyone else. And then, of course, what we saw was the drive by these pimps of war, as I call them in my latest column, which is on chrishedges.substack.com, the neocons, same people that I dealt with in Central America when I covered the wars in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala, Elliot Abrams, Robert Kagan, who worked for Abrams. These people have been beating the drums of conflict for decades. They're orchestrated or, you know, largely were responsible for building the push to invade Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, everywhere else. Of course, the bombing of Serbia. I also covered that war. And they work for the arms industry. I mean, the defense contractors fund the Brookings Institution and Century for the Project for New American Century, which is eventually was closed down because it was so discredited over the Iraq War, and of course they appear constantly on our networks. It doesn't matter on the commercial networks. It doesn't matter how many times they were wrong or what idiocies they espouse. And the defense industry saw a multi-billion-dollar bonanza in converting the Soviet bloc militaries into NATO compatible military systems, and I mean, Poland just, for instance, signed a $6 billion contract to buy M1 Abrams tanks. So, and of course, this war has been a bonanza. So they did, despite repeated protests by Russia, 14 countries have been integrated into NATO. The Clinton administration, to calm Moscow down, told Russia that they would not station NATO troops in Eastern and Central Europe. That also turned out to be a lie. So Russia has legitimate historical grievances. You can't defend NATO as a defensive force. I cover the wars in the Middle East. The idea, ask an Iraqi or an Afghan or a Syrian if NATO is a defensive force, and they would find that question ridiculous. So that doesn't absolve Russia of the war crime of preemptive war, and I denounced it. I had a show on RT and denounced the invasion of Ukraine, but they were clearly baited, and they pulled the trigger. And now, of course, it's this very cynical policy embraced by the West, which is to turn the Ukraine into another Chechnya or the old Afghanistan, where you bog the Soviet Union down in a military quagmire to, in their language, make Russia bleed. But, of course, the tragedy is the people who will truly bleed are the Ukrainians. There's no incentive on the part of the Ukrainians to negotiate any kind of a settlement with the staggering sums of arms that are being poured into the Ukraine to perpetuate this war. We saw Germany lift its export. It had, since World War II, an export ban on weapons. They lifted that ban. They nearly tripled their defense budget and announced that Germany would now henceforth spend 2% of GDP on its military, which will make the German military the third largest in the world after the United States and China. So the entire project itself was unnecessary. I wrote a column called Chronicle of a War Foretold. We all saw it coming. George Kennan said that the expansion of NATO was the greatest blunder of the post-Cold War era, and this is where we are. And, of course, now we're flirting with a hot war with Russia. And I think what's so disturbing is that these same figures who have orchestrated debacle after debacle are stoking the fires of a conflict with Russia itself. This is Elliot Abrams writing in on the count. He's at the Council on Foreign Relations, which is where these people parked. They're just kind of circular. They go to places like there or the Brookings Institution, and then go back into government. But they have all been calling for the mantra that they always chant is increased defense spending. And, bomb and attack. They were, of course, calling during the Clinton administration for attacking Saddam Hussein. So they are the propagandists for the war industry. And that is why it doesn't matter how many fiascos they help orchestrate. They kind of can never go away.
Well, there's a sentence that I want to lift from one of your pieces. The Dr. Strangeloves, like zombies rising from the mass graves they created around the globe, are once again stoking new campaigns of industrial mass slaughter. What a magnificent, tragically poetic statement, and what an expression of what you've been saying, and a capsule of what you've been saying about the profiteers of war and hegemonistic endeavors of empire and of NATO. But I want to, this isn't, of course, just for us an intellectual exercise or an academic expression. We look to build a mass, rekindle a mass anti-war movement, an anti-imperialist war movement. And with that, I want to also address the role of the media here that has shaped much of the Russiaphobe, the terrifying sensationalism of course, war is a crime against humanity. It's not very hard to sensationalize that. But when you take it out of context and you exaggerate it, that's one thing. But and I'm talking more about the cable media in particular, because the right has played an interesting role in all of this for political reasons, which we can get into. But I'm talking about so-called liberal media and the saber rattling that has fanned the flames and also propagated the voices. And it didn't just start with the Ukraine, certainly, of generals, federal prosecutors, FBI agents, and the like. And what that has meant to stoking the conflict. And if I may also to address my comrades, if you will, on the left, who similarly will say that everything that is happening in Ukraine is a false flag operation, become apologists for the atrocities of war as a result of the invasion of Russia. So if you can kind of help us parse out and address those issues, starting with the propaganda and how we can situate ourselves to really rekindle the demands of diplomacy and negotiation versus stoking and expanding the war.
Yeah, well, these are entities that are kind of bonded at the hip with the war industry. Those figures, even on ostensibly liberal media like MSNBC, who are anti-war, Jesse Ventura, Phil Donahue were removed. I think Donahue's show was the most watched on MSNBC because they opposed the Iraq war. Their so-called experts are drawn from the intelligence and the defense community and usually sit on boards of corporations like Raytheon, where they're paid staggering sums of money, $500,000 a year. None of that is ever disclosed. Critics of war, even if you have the kind of experience that I have had, I spent 7 years in the Middle East, I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, are denied any kind of a platform because you don't repeat the dominant narrative. So, Condoleezza Rice, they've all been resurrected. These people are war, under international law, these people are war criminals. The cable media, the commercial media is complicit in the same way that they were in stoking and defending and pushing for the war in Iraq. But this could end very, very badly because once you open that Pandora's box of war, you don't control it. I've covered wars all over the globe. It controls you. And you can stumble yourself into a country can stumble into a real nightmare. We're already hearing talk of limited tactical nuclear weapons. Stationing U.S. troops right along the border. Of course, we've established a missile base that's 100 miles, a NATO missile base that's 100 miles from the Russian border. I mean, we almost went to war in Cuba. We had a nuclear showdown with the Soviet Union when they were trying to put missiles in Cuba, which is 90 miles off the coast of Florida. I mean, this is really dangerous. And unfortunately, the voices of sanity have been locked out because the war industry is making a killing. They lamented the loss of Afghanistan. The only reason we stayed in Afghanistan, we know from the Afghan papers that were published by the Washington Post, that the military and political leadership years ago recognized that the war in Afghanistan was unwinnable, was a quagmire, but it was perpetuated because it was highly profitable to these corporations. It was the only reason. It never made any geopolitical sense to expand NATO up to Russia's borders. It made commercial sense for these corporations, but not geopolitical sense. In fact, it was deeply counterproductive. So we're just hostage to this war industry. and we can't shake ourselves free of it. They drive policy, and the policy is really determined by what makes them money rather than what makes sense.
So you look at, for example, the Rachel Maddows, who was considered, at one point worked with ACT UP and came from the left publication, The Nation magazine, and who has been brought back from a hiatus now to chirp along with the with the spread of war. And it's characterized as a humanitarian imperative to defend the self-determination, if you will, of Ukraine. Of course, we don't say that about the Western Sahara in terms of the occupation of Morocco of the Western Sahara. There, the issue of self-determination is not respected. The U.S., of course, supports completely and totally the occupation of Western Sahara by Morocco. We don't and then we have Ali Belchi, who is, again, a presumed liberal force who was given all kinds of accolades and brought to speak before organizations like the Legal Aid Society for his liberal sensitivities. He's in Ukraine a week and is calling for a no-fly zone, which is an extension and desperate, painful, problematic of war. So is this... speaking as a journalist, what have they been perverted, or it's just there's no way you can be in well-financed media without accommodating yourself to the sponsors, to the money that's pouring in? Is that how we have to understand the role of the fourth estate now, which should be some check and balance on the machinations of the war industry and the worst manifestations of control and hegemony of the plutocracy? I mean, is that where we are at?
Yeah, you can't challenge the war industry. I tried that when I worked at the New York Times and denounced the calls to invade Iraq and was pushed out of the town and lynched by the right-wing media. You can't. So these people are careerists. They don't. I watched, for instance, going back to the war in Iraq. So I'm an Arabic speaker. As I said, I spent 7 years in the Middle East, months of my life in Iraq. But because I wouldn't parrot back the dominant message, which was war, 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 I was shut out. And I watched all these so-called experts who have no experience in the Middle East sit on these cable channels and everywhere else and stoke the flames of conflict. Any Arabist anywhere, even in the intelligence community or the State Department, realized that invading Iraq was the debacle that it soon became. It was self-apparent, but we couldn't say it. We could say it, but we weren't given a place within public discourse in which to make that argument. So these people like Maddow and others, they're careerists. They know which way the winds blow. They know what's good for their career. They don't actually know anything about Ukraine or the Middle East or anywhere else. But they know they're tremendous self-promoters, and they're very well paid for it. And I think that the real issue is careerism. That's it.
Well, you know, that'll take us to at some point other discussions about people like John McChesney and John Nichols, who are working to really make sure that what we need for the Fourth Estate, for media, is public funding, so that we are not beholden to public funding of community-based media and, of course, support of stations and networks like Pacifica, WBAI. Chris Hedges, I want to take us back to how you respond to the, for example, my neighbors, very nice people who are have their kids out, and I think it's fine, on the street selling yellow and blue cookies in support of the children, the refugees of Ukraine and so on. And that's lovely, and that's an important and wonderful philosophic anti-war gesture. Of course, it's not often extended because the media doesn't extend it to refugees from African countries, from the Caribbean, from Central America, certainly not the Haitians. But, you know, the issue of white supremacy is alive and well, and certainly our listeners understand that as to how people respond to international catastrophe and who is given a preference. But within that, how do you understand or respond to what the dominant narrative is of, again, so-called liberal media, which is we must, if not engage directly in a no-fly zone, what we must continue to pour weapons in order to defend Ukraine. And then there are other people on the other side who say, wait a minute, Ukraine is involved in the Nazification of government, that has as a dominant member of its National Guard, the Azov Brigade, that are fascist. So how are we to understand Ukraine and indeed addressing a humanitarian catastrophe that is playing out and is playing out dominantly and specifically as a result of the invasion and the bombardment of the Russians?
Right. Well, this gets into the whole issue of worthy and unworthy victims. So what about the 37 million refugees caused by our wars, our war against terror, our wars in the Middle East? What about the selling cookies for the Iraqi refugees or the Syrian refugees, the Libyan refugees, or the Somali refugees, or the Yemeni? I mean, Yemen's a catastrophe. 7 years, and of course, it's largely our weapon systems that are provided to the Saudis to carry out this slaughter. So Chomsky and Ed Herman write about this in Manufacturing Consent. So we pick victims, of course, helps when they're white. So we see it's about ourselves. It's about us as empathetic and compassionate people, and of course we demonize the aggressor, and yet 20 years of war crimes in the Middle East, we utterly ignore that human suffering. It somehow doesn't exist, and that's what we're seeing here. So worthy victims, are used to express this kind of sanctimonious. They're not only used this sanctimonious kind of outrage, but also to stoke these feelings of self-adulation and nationalism. And I think we're seeing that with Ukraine. So when you have worthy victims, it is about you essentially entering this binary world of good and evil. I mean, for instance, I cover the war in El Salvador, where Archbishop Oscar Romero had been assassinated. Four church women had been raped and assassinated. This was during the Reagan administration, 1984. A Catholic priest is murdered by the communist regime in Poland, and they can't talk about, or they can't use that murder to excoriate the Polish communist government enough while ignoring the attacks on priests and church people in El Salvador itself. So that's a perfect example of worthy and unworthy victims. But when you divide the world into worthy and unworthy victims, what you're really doing is eradicating the possibility of a world based on the rule of law. So I am willing to accept that Putin is a war criminal, and I'm even willing to accept dragging him to The Hague, but George W. Bush better be in the cell next to him. If you don't apply the rule of law evenly, then you don't live in a rules-based world. So our war criminals are as guilty as other war criminals. But of course, like Russia, we don't recognize the validity of the international court. So that's the problem. The problem is divided into worthy and unworthy victims. So all is heartfelt, and I don't want to minimize the suffering of Ukrainians, and they should be helped. But you know, the life of a Yemeni child or a Palestinian child or a Somali child is just as precious as the life of a Ukrainian child.
So how do you see positioning oneself in terms of the development of an anti-war, an anti-imperialist war movement? Certainly there must be the condemnation and understanding of the role of NATO as a stoker, as a provocateur. There has to be an understanding additionally of the certainly the crimes of empire of the Russians who seek hegemony and the reconstitution of the pre-Soviet land base. There's also the contradictions in the Ukrainian government. And it's certainly not about the denazification. That is not the nature of the government there, although it has its ultra-right, its fascist elements, as we do here, as we do here. But that is not the essential characterization of the government of Ukraine. So how are we to situate ourselves and look at what the demands that we must advance to begin to drag kicking and screaming these recalcitrant entities to a bargaining table to stop the spread of war and what looks like it will be a kind of war of attrition for years and years to come?
Well, the policy is to sustain the conflict in a way to entrap the Soviet Union. That's the policy. So if there isn't a moratorium on weapons to the Ukraine, I mean, there also has to be a call for Russian troops to leave the Ukraine. The conflict is going to be sustained for a very, very long time with devastating consequences for the Ukrainians. That's the cynicism. So on one side of their mouths, the ruling elites are talking about the suffering of the Ukrainian people, and on the other side, they're perpetuating that suffering. I think we have to recognize that, as Alexander Berkman said, the military-industrial complex is the enemy from within. Until we are able to regulate, control, and diminish the power of the war industry, they are going to determine, in essence, our foreign policy, which is one that is unnecessarily aggressive, not only against Russia, but against China, because that's what makes them money.
You know, Chris Hedges, I want you to put on your philosophic hat, if you will, not that you haven't had it on already, but we've gone kind of from historian, journalist to right now the culture of war. How do you look at the advent of this war and the behavior and feeding of it and those who would wish to expand it for profit motive and for political reason of the U.S. in the sense that we have a habitual culture of war, that those who are going to be most harmed by it seem to gravitate with great ease? We have the saber rattling and the warmongering and the profiteering. And how is it? When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn, as the song says, that after the disasters of Afghanistan, after the disasters of Iraq, after the Central America, and the almost endless and perpetual activity and warmongering of NATO in this country, how is it that we, again, can so readily adopt the attitude of war and militarism and accept that as opposed to the language of diplomacy and negotiation and of peace? How do you look at that? And what does it say about the nature of the state of the U.S. now?
Well, it is a culture of permanent war. Those voices who call for diplomacy and peace and restraint and understanding. I mean, I was a foreign correspondent for 2 decades. My job was to be linguistically, culturally, historically, religiously literate, to explain how other societies and peoples viewed us, why they viewed us the way they did, and often their grievances were very, very legitimate and deserved a hearing. All of that's kind of gone. The media, in essence, acts as a kind of echo chamber for the war industry itself. And if you attempt to challenge this, you are very quickly shut out. I mean, all of the people who sold us the war in Iraq, all of these pundits, George Packer and Thomas Friedman, and they were all wrong. And those of us who understood what was going to happen with this invasion are still locked out. Well, we're locked out because we don't serve those centers of power. And this is extremely corrosive and extremely dangerous, not only in terms of foreign policy or external relations, but for our democracy itself. We're held completely captive by the war industry. And it's bipartisan. It doesn't really matter whether it's Republican or Democrat. I mean, people like Victoria Nuland, who was Dick Cheney's chief foreign policy advisor, served in the Obama White House and now serves in the Biden White House. They shift parties. They're cold warriors, then they're neocons, then they're liberal interventionists. And what we have seen, they turned on Trump because Trump did not want to stoke a war with Russia. He called Iraq a big fat mistake, and you saw the establishment Republican Party leaders essentially join forces with the establishment Democratic Party leaders to try and battle back against the neo-fascist forces around Trump. But I think much of the hatred for these unelected, arrogant, smug, and facile elites that drive this war policy is legitimate and expressed often by support for Trump. We can't, they're beyond our control. It doesn't matter how many mistakes they make or what kind of idiocies they utter. I mean, remember after 9/11, Donald Kagan, who was a Yale professor, right-wing ideologue, and Fred Kagan, who was Robert Kagan's brother. I mean, they're all this kind of incestuous family. They were calling for stationing U.S. troops in Gaza. They're out of their minds. Elliot Abrams is out of his mind. But they are given prominent megaphones because the corporations, the defense contractors that fund them, use them as their shills for war.
Well, we have to have you back. These are such critical discussions, and they go to the root of the devolution of the very fragile indicia of democracy that we have in this country, which is eroding, and we have running full scale in, galloping in, a alt-right, fascist, proto-fascist movement that has everything to do with the plutocrats in control and the policies of endless war of this country. I want people to really take seriously the words of Chris Hedges and to follow Chris Hedges on chrishedges.substack.com. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back and join us. And I wonder if you have a final thought to take us at, as, again, the purpose of these discussions are to educate and inform ourselves, to organize, to stop the war, and to build the kind of anti-imperialist, anti-war movement that stops all wars.
Well, we have to break with that political system, Democrat and Republican, that perpetuates this insanity, which is why I was Ralph Nader's speechwriter and have not voted for a Democratic presidential candidate since 2000. In every thing that we do. We have to stand up against the power of the war industry, and that means defying the system, even if we're a tiny minority.
Well, Chris Hedges, thank you, and that's perhaps the next theme that we'll take up with you. For all that you do, we appreciate your spending the time with us and your work.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And we have been speaking with Chris Hedges. And again, Chris Hedges can be found on chrishedges.substack.com, substack.com, that is. And do read his books. Do read his books.
Looking back through time, we are in debt to the leaders. Angels of mercy, everyone. Good folks who believe there was no good and evil. Fought long and hard until the battles all were won.
They came to America to escape from inter-ethnic wars in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Central Africa. Like many refugees of war, they thought that America was the land of peace. The Loyola family settled in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and began living their lives as refugees have done for generations. But something as small as a traffic incident revealed the limits of the land of peace. 26-year-old Patrick Loyola faced a car stop when he apparently felt unsafe after a cop stopped his vehicle. He bursts into a sprint with a cop in hot pursuit. When the cop pulls a taser, Loyola seems to cover it with his hands, thus blocking its effect. Someone points a phone cam at the altercation, which shows a cop, seemingly, on Loyola's back, pushing his head downward. A shot is heard, and Patrick Loyola is gone, dead from a bullet in the back of his head. Once again, driving while black is a capital offense. For love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Now, from another pointed social commentary from Prison Radio that actually pierces the heart and soul by Mumia Abu-Jamal, journalist who tells it like it is, and for the downtrodden and otherwise voiceless, political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal of 40 years. We're joined by the founder of Prison Radio and a newly minted lawyer who's joined Mumia's legal team, Noel Hanrahan, to celebrate Mumia Abu-Jamal's 68th birthday after 40 years of unjust incarceration. It is so good to have you. It is so good to have you. And happy birthday from both of us, right, to Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Right. Exactly. Noel, well, thank you for having me on.
I know that you just visited, I believe, 2 days ago, Mumia. So let's begin by talking about the state of the health of Mumia and giving us an update on his legal case, and then we will truly launch into and want people to join with us to call in and celebrate Mumia Abu-Jamal. Noelle?
So Mumia's situation is dire and urgent. He is recovering from congestive heart failure and double bypass surgery. So that means that he needs what is medically indicated, a cardiac diet, which he cannot get right now within the Pennsylvania prison system. Literally, the diet there causes cardiac events and causes diabetes. And also, he's unable to get exercise. So I was deeply disturbed when I saw him because I grilled down and just went through with him to try and see, like, how much out-of-cell time does he get? He is in his cell 21 hours a day, and he only can walk 8 steps forward and backwards. There's no room to go side to side. The 3 hours a day that he's out are 70-minute periods, and they are the day room. And he also has to take showers during that time and make phone calls, and he can only, you know, pace in the day room. So that those kinds of conditions for someone in his situation, he's going to be 68. He's had double bypass heart surgery. He needs these predictable and what anyone would get in terms of recovery. So that's very concerning. He's also had other events fairly recently that make him more vulnerable. So he had hepatitis C, and it took years, literally years, for us to sue and force the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections to treat him with a cure. Like, they discovered these cures in 2013 and 2014, and he only got the cure for hep C in 17. What that means is that he has a greater risk for liver cancer. Each year that you're not treated, you get a 10% greater chance of getting liver cancer. And then he has conditions that were very much made worse by his vulnerabilities around his hepatitis C when it became chronic and active. He, for the first time, had gotten extensive psoriasis and eczema. And this was like the kind that you see on bus shelters. You know, it's like deep wounds. And having open wounds in prison is very dangerous. And so now he has a medical regime that he still suffers from this extrahepatic skin condition. He must get proper treatment for that, and it's difficult for him to get it. So in the past couple months, the UV light treatment that he got, the machine was broken. And, of course, from like 3 months, they didn't fix it. So that really took energy on our part to get them to fix that because that was one of the best treatments for him. He had soothing medical baths at the infirmary, but that's been made much more difficult because of that's where all the COVID cases are. So he is deeply trying to take care of his health, yet he is very vulnerable, and we need to keep that in mind, that Mumia's freedom is urgent. He cannot recover, and he nor should he be in prison. So he spent 40 years in prison, and he has a great legal case. I mean, great legal team, great legal case, moving through the courts. Right now, Mumia, you know, the people elected the district attorney, Larry Krasner. And Larry Krasner, unlike other district attorneys prior to him, prior to the people's DA, he was unwilling to bury evidence. So when he got there, he found the pathological pack rats files, and he found evidence that they had suppressed in Mumia's case, Brady evidence, evidence that they paid witnesses, evidence that they manufactured positive dispositions to witnesses' cases, evidence that they took blacks off the jury specifically because of their race. So these kinds of things are really dramatic, and they trigger a new trial. Well, the other side is going to try and delay. And also Larry Krasner, you know, when he came into his office, he didn't fire everyone. He fired half the people. You know, the turnover was vast, but not enough. So he has a whole lot of vision, and he has a lot of people who are very willing to prop up the wrongs of the past, to pretend that the system has options in terms of relief, which they in Pennsylvania they don't. It's very, very difficult to get relief in the Conviction Integrity Unit and or in the Post-Conviction Relief Act courts, the Common Pleas courts. So pretending that those things are working for people who need relief and who deserve relief is really a tragedy. And so that's part of the problem, is that Larry Krasner has actually pledged to uphold those rules, regulations, policies, and laws that prevent people from getting access to the courts. He's not willing to bury evidence, but he is willing to just about use every other tactic to delay relief. So delay is going to be the problem in Mumia's case.
Now, Noel, you, as I indicated, were the founder of Prison Radio. You have worked long before you got your sheepskin for Mumia, indeed decades, and was perhaps the seminal person who in media really brought the voice and attention to this humanitarian, to this brilliant journalist. You brought, indeed, and helped stimulate worldwide attention to this political prisoner. But I want you, in your own words, to tell us why you work for Mumia and why you think we should be using this airtime, why we should be celebrating the 68th birthday of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Who is Mumia Abu-Jamal? And I do want to, in the meantime, give people our phone number to call in and with birthday celebrations for Mumia and to lift him up as well, because we're going to, of course, record this and we're going to make sure that Mumia gets this and hears our birthday greetings. And the number you can call in is 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877 for the birthday greeting to Mumia. But Noel, tell us, why should we be celebrating the birthday of Mumia Abu-Jamal?
I think it's difficult to say the word celebration. I know that when someone is in prison, when your loved one is in prison, when many of us have people in prison, and even Mumia, it's hard to say celebrate, but we have to recognize that survival and freedom are the things that we need to honor. So we're honoring the fact that Mumia, the entire time that he has been in prison, he has reached out to us. He has honored our work by joining our work. And that's what I want to honor. And, you know, it's as a journalist, like I was at KPFA radio. That's where I got my start. And if you are working in the media, your obligation is to tell the truth and to stand up for voices that need to be heard, to need to be brought into the public debate and dialogue. There are many situations where journalists are censored and where you're given a choice. You either work or you are fired. You know, you either do what your conscience tells you to do, which is report the stories that need to be told. And more often than not, you will be fired. And that is including at places like BAI and KPFA. And so Mumia is that person. He never turned away from his community nor the truth. And that's what I would like to honor and to realize and to join him in honoring him, that he survived and that now the call is for Mumia's freedom. Literally, if you are working on Mumia, you need, if you believe in Mumia, if you've been moved by Mumia, if you want his freedom, if you think he deserves his freedom, you need to join Love Not Fear. You need to do what Mumia is asking of you. I was thinking a lot this morning about, look, Mumia's given 50 years, over 50 years. He was in the Black Panther Party and reporting and beginning his career when he's 14. He's been giving and serving us and the people for over half a century. It's now our turn to give back to Mumia and to take some steps that are going to free him. And that means trusting the leadership of the people that he has chosen to lead the movement, and that is Jamal Hart Jr., his grandson, and Mike Africa Jr., and Yane Indigo, and really believe that love, not fear, and the love. You know, it's all about love. It's about showing people who Mumia really is. It's about that warm, gracious, dedicated, nerdy scholar. I mean, that literally, and the person who's willing to take the heat. I mean, Mumia, of all people.
Well, I want you to hold the rest of that thought, Noel, because I don't want to run out of time for our listeners who are calling in also. So I just want them to join in that. I think of the ideas across. Again, we want to get as many calls in to make sure that Mumia hears us. And based on the things that Noel has said, which are just a small recountation of the dedication of Mumia all these years. 212-209-2877. Let's take our first caller.
My dearest Mumia, this is Judith from the Upper West Side. And I'm so happy that there is so much love and support for you because you're the greatest. And we're going to make a birthday party for you here in New York and in 40 other cities. And at this birthday party, I'll be telling all the jokes that I really want to tell you. The birthday party will be at 68 Avenue C next to 5th Street in the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
And Judith, I'm going to give those coordinates as we go out. That is 68 Avenue C. I will tell you that's on Sunday. And we thank you for your call. We have so many folks coming in, Judith. Thank you. Let's get some more of those celebration of the life and commitment of the revolutionary Mumia Abu-Jamal. Thank you for calling. You are on with that message.
Yes, thank you. I'm Elle from Long Island. Had the privilege, the honor of celebrating Mumia Abu-Jamal's birthday, his 60th birthday in Philadelphia. And I am so happy that I'm able to give this message again on his upcoming birthday, the 68th. This is Elle from Long Island.
Thank you.
Keep on the move. And you have all of us behind you.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And you are on the air, and we want to hear your message for Say It Loud, Say It Clear, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Wow. So, Mumia, we love you without question. Happy birthday to you. But the question I have is this. How can we help? Can we get other attorneys involved to assist or things of that nature?
Well, we're going to tell you before we go out. Time is running. We thank you from calling. Where are you calling from?
I'm actually in Brooklyn right now. I'm in New York.
Right on. We've got Brooklyn. We have the Upper West Side. We have Long Island in the house. Let's get another message on before the tyranny of the clock catches up with us. Thank you for calling. We'll give you that information before we go out. And you are on the air for your celebratory message of the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yes, hello. This is Claudette from Queens. Peace and blessings, Mumia. Wishing you a happy birthday and positive outcomes. Keeping you in prayer every day.
Beautiful.
And happy birthday.
Beautiful. And I am being beckoned by the clock to get that final information in. And I will give it to you myself, and then we'll get the final message from Noel. And that is, yes, this Sunday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., Sunday, April 24th, you can come to 68 Avenue C, the corner of 5th Avenue and Avenue C in Manhattan, 68 Avenue C, corner of 5th Avenue and Avenue C, for a many hours of celebration of Mumia Abu-Jamal's 68th birthday after 40 years of unjust incarceration. And you will be able to speak truth to power as Mumia always does, connecting all the issues from climate to militarization. So celebrate with us this Sunday, April 24th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And we've got 20 seconds. Noel, take us out. What is to be done? Noel?